Chapter 7, Built to Last. The romantic in me loves autumn. The melancholic in me needs a little bit of winter. The optimist in me thrives with the hopefulness of spring. But the child in me needs summer. Summer, oh summer. Summer is a dip in the deep end of a pool and the smell of fresh cut grass on the lawn. It's the elated cry of school's out as kids stream out of the building and pile into yellow buses for the last time until fall. Summer is fireflies in the air, kittens in the barn, and hamburgers on the charcoal grill. We'll serve those burgers on skillet-toasted buns alongside sliced tomatoes and Iowa sweet corn slathered in real butter. For farmers, there's still work to be done in summer. They need to keep a keen eye on things like pests and weeds and weather. Animals need feeding, fences need mending. But on our farm, summers offer brief respites when we can get away. When the girls were quite young, we started saving up money for summer road trips. We didn't want to wait until someday to make memories together out in this great, big, wonderful world with its breathtaking mountain vistas, bubbling trout streams, and expansive cities of tall, mirrored buildings. Of course, traveling with little humans was intensely chaotic. There's nothing quite like a road trip to test the limits of a family's love. Someone always needs to pee when you're miles away from a bathroom. Someone is always blaming someone else for farting, chewing too loudly, or crossing over the iconic invisible line that has, for generations, existed to keep one kid from invading another kid's personal space. Thanks to the Tetris skills my husband and I honed in high school, we could arrange the trunk with all the required equipment we needed in the early days: breast pump, portable crib, diapers, strollers, DVDs, gallons of hand sanitizer, an unreasonable number of must-have blankies, and the children's weight in goldfish crackers. Once, before we set out on an adventure, our young Anna secretly emptied her suitcase of all of its contents and replaced it entirely with stuffed animals. We didn't realize what she'd done until we arrived at the hotel late at night. She was without a toothbrush or clean underwear, but hey, she had enough plush critters to fill a small ark. Even with the chaos, we insisted on traveling each summer, partly to learn about the world and partly to learn about ourselves. Travel is mercifully easier with teens who own AirPods. The girls are mostly kind to one another, mind the invisible line, and even help plan the itinerary. When I look at my girls, I see summer personified, growing brighter as days lengthen and carrying a warm light and curiosity within them. I never thought I'd enjoy parenting teens. I harbored mild trepidation that this would be an angst-filled season, but spending time with them is one of my greatest joys. Our summer trips have occasionally taken us far from home. In mid-June, after the corn and soybeans had been planted, we caught a flight across the ocean. Our family spent 2 weeks touring London, Bath, and Paris, staying in Airbnbs and stopping at vendor stands for cheese, crepes, cappuccinos, and crusty bread wrapped in paper. While walking the cobblestone streets of Bath, Lydia carried with her a backpack of books. And at points in the journey, the Royal Crescent, the Pump Room, the Theatre Royal, she would produce a Jane Austen novel and perform for us a short reading, accompanied by grand flourishes and a terrible British accent. The theatrics annoyed her younger sister to no end. While we each had varying interest in Jane Austen, we could all agree on the impressiveness of Europe's palaces and cathedrals. I don't think you have to build a big cathedral to impress God, but there's something very breathtaking about a structure like that, one that rises high to scrape the sky, amplifying the voices of centuries of dreamers and grievers and saints and schemers and vagabonds and anyone who accidentally encountered something holy when they thought they might simply get a nice photo of a building. All around us, permanence and legacy made itself evident. Everything was, as they say, built to last. Not just in those grand structures like Westminster Abbey, the Royal Crescent, or the Arc de Triomphe, but in tucked away places like old hotels and centuries-old taverns. One afternoon, while walking in London, we stumbled upon a bookstore called Hatchard's. We marveled at the five-story building with its impressive wooden staircase. A saleswoman helped Lydia peruse the Jane Austen section and later told us that the shop had been selling books since 1797. Think about that for a moment. The creaky floorboards of that building have supported the written word for something like eight generations. Built to last. Those were the words Scott kept repeating as we walked around the city. After we returned home, I asked myself, what does it take to grow something that's built to last? For Hatchard's, longevity is credited to a great location, a charming facility, a dedicated and knowledgeable staff, and the mad audacity to keep pushing forward no matter what. I want that kind of mad audacity reflected in my own life. In a throwaway culture driven by consumerism, Hatchard's stands out. The store is an exception in a world that seems to favor excessive, single-use production. Instead of repairing, we replace. We don't patch things, we purge. Washing machines last, what, 10 years? Some of what we buy is actually built to fail. It sounds crazy, but it's true. There's even a term for it, planned obsolescence. Planned obsolescence is a business strategy where products are designed to deliberately fail. They cannot be repaired, require updates, or have a set lifespan. If you had to go to the store for an update on your mobile phone, you have experienced planned obsolescence. Not only do you eventually buy an upgraded phone, you have to purchase a new charger or adapter to go with it. The entire fashion industry is built around what's in style, a form of planned obsolescence where you're convinced that the clothes in your closet are outdated. It's not a stretch to say that this mindset infects what we care about most: relationships, faith communities, our health, even the land. We all want new and beautiful things to spring forth to new life. We want our lives to reflect meaningful work that can change the world. But growth that stands the test of time simply cannot be rushed. We can't expect to have Hatchard's longevity while running at a Hardee's pace. Yet we are running at warp speed with an insatiable hunger for immediate results. People want meaning and connection, but they don't always take time to build the foundation that will help make a relationship last. A couple starts attending a new church, but even a little dissatisfaction can send them out the door in search of something better somewhere else. We eat so fast we don't taste our food. We rarely take the long way home, missing the scenery, because we want to get where we want to go, and we want to get there now. Hurry is the enemy of beauty. Beauty comes when we stay instead of run, when we taste instead of shovel in, when we take the long way home after work and see the brightest blue sky open before us. Quicker is not always better. There's nothing wrong with meeting goals swiftly. Some moments really are made for hustling. But the desire to build quickly is dangerous. It can hurt the foundational pillars that hold up our relationships, businesses, and health. Let's stop glorifying the end results and start embracing the day-by-day process of building something beautiful with our lives. We have bought into the deception that a meaningful life is the result of achieving goals, but meaning isn't found in the rush for results. Quite often, meaning is found in the struggle. With all that is within me, I am convinced that God is far less concerned with how quickly we meet quotas and more interested in the people we are becoming as we embrace slow growth. He takes joy in seeing how we are willing to walk in obedience while refusing to compromise our personal integrity in the name of achievement. God delights in watching us grow the virtues of patience and perseverance in our lives. It brings him happiness to see us grow into the kind of women who hold ourselves to high ideals, who develop habits of fidelity and humility, who lean on him in the struggle, who sacrifice, who trust that that He will keep His promises even when we can't see progress. Slow growth is less fixated on the end prize and more about long-term personal transformation. God is making each of us built to last, like Hatchards with skin on, with souls and hearts that beat like this, Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. Remember in chapter 3 where we learned anew that each of us is God's field? There's more. Listen to this from the Bible. You are God's field. You are also God's building. Brick by brick, God is building you into the fullness of all He created you to be as a daughter of God. God's ways of maturing His people can seem needlessly, even painfully slow. But God is not slow in the way that we think of slowness. The Lord is not slow in keeping His promise, as some understand slowness. Instead, He is patient with you. There is no 10-step plan to become a better you. It's a plan with a million steps, taken incrementally over a life, toward a glorious harvest. When you lay your head down on your pillow at night, you may wonder what you have to show for your day. If that's you, I wish you could see what God sees. You are building something with your life, something built to last. The story of Hatchards reveals that it's possible to build something that lasts, something that will outlive us. It's possible to live a small, quiet life and make a mark on our world simply by taking care of our people and our fields. In the same way, generations of Hatchards owners and employees have taken care of a store since 1797. What do you want to last? What will matter most 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 100 years from now? Maybe you want to leave a trail of love and kindness. Maybe you want to be known as generous or wise, or the kind of person who gave everyone a reason to laugh and smile. As for me, I hope my marriage is built to last, a steady foundation and an example for generations to come. I hope my books are built to last, offering timeless encouragement to real souls for years to come. I hope my parenting is built to last, that I'm living life in a way that helps my children and their children love Jesus with everything that is in them. My church, my community, my faith, my friendships. I pray it's all built to last. Let's refuse to bend to impulse. Instead, doing our little part every day to help create goodness and beauty that will stand the test of time. The more I ponder these questions of legacy, the more I come alive, because I don't feel the pressure to make something marvelous. I am seeing instead how God is making something marvelous in me, a soul built to love Him and enjoy Him forever. The truth is, in 100 years, I likely won't be remembered at all. My books will be out of print. Who knows if my little church will be standing? Perhaps my name will be written by my great-great-grandson on an ancestral chart his teacher sends home for a school project. But God will have built something to last in me. Every struggle, every heartbreak, every success, every failure teaches me something about who God is. He is dropping seeds into the soil of my heart. I hope these words bring you encouragement today. Even if your family doesn't remember your name 100 years from now, something is growing in you and through you. Who you are becoming today influences the becoming of those closest to you right now. And their becoming influences the becoming of real souls in the next generation and in untold generations after that. It's a ripple effect that spans across generations, that a people not yet created may praise the Lord. Built to fall. A few months ago, our family took another trip, this time to a beach far from home. One sunny day, from under the shade of my umbrella, I watched as a father and son spent hours building a sandcastle. I'd look up from my book every now and then to see a girl or an old man or another dad stop for a few minutes to help. It was a pretty cool picture of community, all these strangers under one big sky taking time to work together simply for the sake of making something beautiful. By the end of the day, the castle had multiple towers, a moat, and features like molded stone facing and stairs, all painstakingly sculpted into the sand. The father and his boy stood back and admired their work. They had built their castle far enough from the ocean's edge to avoid the incoming tide. Still, there was little doubt that despite the many hours of work that went into the structure and all the hands that built it, that castle was eventually going down. The next morning, our family headed to the same spot on the beach. We found chairs and spread out our towels on them. I looked around to find the castle, and predictably, it was in ruins. But behind the ruins were the man and the son who built it. And they were building once again. To me, it all seemed rather pointless to begin rebuilding something that surely wouldn't stand. I walked over to talk to them. "So sorry about your castle, guys," I said. "I really enjoyed watching you build it yesterday." The father spoke with a smile. "Oh, don't be sorry. Not at all. We know these castles won't last," he said as he patted a handful of sand into a new turret. I watched his son, who was happily hauling a bucket of wet sand to the opposite end of the new castle. The boy seemed as carefree as his dad, who, as it turned out, was an architect by trade. I asked the dad what had happened to the castle. It wasn't the tide that swept it away. It wasn't the beachcombing equipment either. Rather, a group of children had jumped on top of the structure, and it crumbled under their weight. I would have been so ticked. But that father was unruffled. "We come to this beach for a week every year, and our favorite part is building castles," he said. "They never last. But this is what we do. It's hard work, but mostly, it's just a lot of fun." I thanked them again and went back to my chair. The dedication of that dad and his son shifted something in me. They built for the sake of building. They did it for fun, for the enjoyment of the process, for the opportunity to work side by side. Sure, they stood back at the end of each day and admired what they had made together, but the end product was not the purpose. The purpose was in the process. You may very well grow some pretty amazing, Hatchard-esque things in this life, slowly and sustainably as God intended. Those things may last a very long time indeed. But not everything you build is meant to last. Not everything will produce a measurable legacy. Your best efforts may be washed away, trampled, or run over. Your best work may one day be forgotten. No one but God may know about the most meaningful things you did with your life because they were done in obscurity when no one was watching but Him. You might think that what you've built with your life so far isn't all that grand, but maybe that's not the point anyway. It's not what you're building, it's who you're building with. Come to the shore, kneel next to your father, and get your knees dirty as the sun warms your back. And when the day comes to a close, stand up next to your father and take a moment to admire what you've done together. Then watch as he turns to you, squeezes your hand, and says, "Wasn't that fun? Let's do it again tomorrow."